I'm Ellie Moxley, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. If your body could speak to you, would it give compliments or complaints? Today, a doctor-turned-journalist tells us what he's learned about the inner workings of the human body. From modern medicine to diet, we'll sift through murky and mysterious claims to see just how much we really know about our health. Then, at the turn of the 20th century, women weren't encouraged to speak up for themselves, but that doesn't mean they didn't deserve recognition. We'll find out what the writing of some local high school girl says about the world they lived in, years before suffrage. We'll wrap up the week with an NFL playoffs edition of A Fan's Notes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. So much science and research dedicated to maintaining the well-being of our bodies, it's rather remarkable how little we actually know and what we're willing to believe when it comes to our health. This is what James Hamblin points out in his book, If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. James is a writer and senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. He joins us from NPR studios in New York City. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Just so our listeners know, I could have introduced you as James Hamblin, ND, but you stepped away from medical practice. Tell me more about that decision.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of things, but I got an opportunity to write for The Atlantic magazine about health and science. And I took a little hiatus from practicing medicine and ended up really enjoying it and feeling like there was a lot of work to be done in this field. And now I've been doing it for 5 years.
And it's my understanding this book kind of began as a web series that you did with the same name. How long have you been filming If Our Bodies Could Talk? And when did you kind of realize that there might actually be a book in those conversations?
Oh, you know, it's a combination of the video series that we do, which explores common questions and sort of health fads and things that we're hearing about in the media, and as well as the writing that I do for the magazine. And I always hope that there would be a book in there someplace. You know, there's a certain type of story that works well in news, and it tends to have to be a little pithier, a little bit higher stakes, and oftentimes you don't have the time or space to really explore some of the subjects that I wanted to get into in a longer form of a whole book.
So a lot of the questions in the book, they're the kind of questions that I feel like a lot of us have heard or asked before. You know, just questions about what goes on inside of our bodies. Things like, does alcohol really kill brain cells? Does it?
Well, it turns out that there are often complexities to these answers that I get into with stories in the book. And yeah, for example, with that one, we know certainly that chronic alcohol abuse does lead to shrinkage of the brain. But also at the same time, in moderation, there is a lot of evidence that 1 to 2 glasses of wine a day is associated with a long, healthy life, sometimes a longer, healthier life, and sometimes doctors recommend it, which is a common theme in the book, that you're looking at things that are not all good or all bad, but totally dependent on dosage and context, and it varies from person to person.
So that wasn't just blanket permission for me to go home and pour myself a glass of red wine as we wait for ice apocalypse here in Kansas City.
Not to get too blandly scientific with the statements, but it should be safe for most people and possibly even beneficial. But also most doctors I know tell people, you know, if you don't enjoy it and there's no reason to start, the potential benefits of having a glass of wine a day aren't worth going out of your way to take it up as a habit.
James, did you know the answer to a lot of these questions when you started, or were there a lot of them that you had to do maybe additional research for or really dig in to kind of find out that nuanced answer?
Yeah, there ended up being a lot of complexity in a lot of these questions that I thought would be more straightforward. There are a lot of examples I could give, but one of them is like, should you be drinking 8 glasses of water a day? That's something a lot of people hear and sounds pretty reasonable. But when I spoke to hydration researchers, Most of them are kind of upset about that rule. They say it's arbitrary, and why are people saying that? Because how much water you need depends totally on how much you've been moving around, how hot it is outside, what you've been eating a lot of salty food, etc. So, you know, some people consider it irresponsible to perpetuate that myth, but at the same time, or that idea. But at the same time, if you just tell people, you know, drink more water and less soda, it sometimes doesn't motivate people in the same way. You need it's nice to have an actual number, an idea of how much is good. So yeah, it's in that gray area of between giving an accurate answer and giving a meaningless scientific response.
People are more willing to maybe act on something concrete, like drink 8 glasses of water versus just like, hey, replace that Coke with some water.
Right. And a similar thing with exercise, where when doctors advise people just get more physical activity, they tend not to change. But when you have a concrete recommendation, like try to get 20 minutes a day or 90 minutes a week, people, those are relatively arbitrary because, of course, more would still be better for most people. But having that number, having that threshold, having it make it feel like when you reach that number, you've really accomplished something, that tends to motivate people.
You know, one of the sections that caught my idea was about gluten, because I have actual diagnosed celiac disease. And I'm always telling, you know, this comes up a lot. You go out to eat, people want to know why you're ordering from the menu with a bunch of substitutions. And, you know, whenever I tell people, oh, I don't eat wheat, they're like, oh, that must be so healthy, I should try that. But I always tell them that there's no reason to unless they actually have celiac disease. I mean, can you back me up here? What do we know about kind of some of these fad diets and, you know, things that kind of come out as, oh, we should cut this out of our diet, or we should cut that out of our diet?
Yeah, gluten is a great story of how nutrition research gets misunderstood. So it clearly is very, very dangerous to people who have celiac disease. It needs to be completely out of their diet. Otherwise, you have a response that can jeopardize your health in serious ways. And because it is so uniquely bad to people with celiac disease, there spread this public idea that it must be bad for everyone and it must be healthy to avoid it. And there is a diagnosis some doctors are using now called gluten sensitivity, which is sort of nebulous and sort of based on people who perceive that they have a sensitivity to gluten, but we haven't found any biological evidence that there is a response going on. So ongoing research in that area. But we certainly know that for the vast majority of the population, there's no evidence of any health benefits to simply eating a gluten-free diet without medical cause. And it potentially can be bad in that you see products like gluten-free brownies. And somehow
they're still brownies, right?
It's just a brownie. Often it's even less healthy than another type of a standard brownie, because for whatever negative comes along with avoiding the gluten, people, they'll put in, you know, maybe more sugar to make up for it so that it's still an enjoyable thing to eat. So it can be misleading as a term if you see it as in any way synonymous with healthy.
You know, one of the major points you return to in the book is agnotology, and it's my understanding that idea was put forth by Stanford professor Robert Proctor. Can you kind of tell me what his thoughts are and kind of what is agnotology?
Yeah, that's something that it's kind of pertinent to a lot of national political conversation right now, but it's been in the mind of a scientific community, a medical research community, for a long time. Agnotology is the study of not knowing, and it's concerned with the purposeful spread of ignorance. The classic example is the tobacco industry, which for decades scientists had at first had reasonable concern, and then had definitive proof that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer. And for years, the tobacco industry tried to combat that. And what they did was not to try to directly take on the evidence, but just to sow the idea that we don't really know, it's not conclusive, experts disagree on this, and in that, and everyone's entitled to their opinion, and all opinions are equally valid, just undermining the idea that you can ever really know anything. And so that made it very hard, and for years, decades, people continued to smoke and weren't really sure how dangerous it was, if it was dangerous at all, even when there was a clear consensus in the medical community.
So very purposeful ignorance in this case.
Yeah, and you see, you see that especially now in, well, with climate science, with a lot of food marketing, where it seems like everyone has their diet that the celebrity might be telling you worked for them, or something you see in an infomercial that promises to alleviate brain fog and swelling in your feet. And it ignores the idea that we actually do know what is best for most people to eat generally, and everyone's opinion, everyone's celebrity diet book isn't equally valid.
I feel like that's another point you repeat a lot in If Our Bodies Could Talk, which is that we're very susceptible to that kind of slick celebrity marketing. You really don't seem to like supplements very much. What's kind of wrong with your daily multivitamin?
Yeah, I hate to rain on the parade of vitamins, because Americans love them, and we have for a long time. But it's a bit of a silver bullet romantic idea, right? That you can just take a pill, take a supplement, and it's going to make all these things better, and it's going to save you time, and that you can, you know, maybe skip meals or not eat as well, or just, you know, eat pizza every night and then take a multivitamin, and that's going to balance out. And it turns out it doesn't. You look at long-term studies of big populations of people who take multivitamins versus not, and there doesn't seem to be a benefit to them across the board. There are rare use case scenarios for certain people with certain dietary specifications, certain medical conditions, where dietary supplements are useful and can be very beneficial. But for simply for an entire population to believe that we all need to be taking these high doses of every single vitamin every day, it's marketing, and it's not just a waste of our money, but it can give people the idea then that you're sort of invincible and can cut corners on your diet, and that's not accurate.
But this is another one of those areas where I feel like there's some nuance, because at the same time, your doctor might recommend you take, say, a specific vitamin for some need that you have.
Exactly. These are things that I think we could stand to look at a little bit more closely to the way we look at pharmaceuticals. We are so fortunate to have great biopharmaceuticals available in this country, and they save lives and they make lives longer and happier and healthier. But if I were to say to you, would you like to take this multi-drug and suggest that everyone should be taking it, and it might include all kinds of different prescription medications, no one would take that. I think with supplements, which tend to have subtler effects than pharmaceuticals, but are bioactive substances, we tend to think, oh, sure, they're all good. There's no side effects. Why not do it?
It almost feels like you're telling me that, you know, there's no magic pill that's going to fix us, that we might actually have to do things like eat a balanced diet and take care of ourselves, you know, to stay healthy.
Yeah. Sorry.
The bearer of bad news.
That's the point that I have to keep coming back to. And yeah, so if you were living a really healthy life and getting plenty of sleep and had good, healthy relationships and eating well and exercising a fair amount, living generally, actively, and then on top of that, you felt like you wanted to take a supplement, you know, that's probably fine. The problem is then that it is people see supplements as an excuse for cutting other corners often.
James, you note that there's a lot of different subspecialties and sub-subspecialties in medicine now. And, you know, as a result, we've kind of maybe lost sight of the connection between our single body parts and the systems that they belong to. Can you kind of give me an example of that and why it might be dangerous?
Yeah. Well, it's a good bad situation. So we've had great advancements in medical technology. We can do things that we couldn't dream about just decades ago, and doctors are becoming so specialized that they focus on just one part of the body. Sometimes even just one element of the body. You're not just an orthopedic surgeon anymore. You're an orthopedic surgeon who focuses exclusively on knees and does knee surgeries, for your entire career. And that's great, but it forces people then to have often multiple different doctors that they have to go to, and systems that aren't connected that make it difficult, create communication difficulties. And then also we have a shortage of primary care physicians, people who are sort of the quarterback of all those specialists and are meant to be just making sure the person as a whole is doing well, and that all these that the overall treatment approach for a person is consistent with what they really want and is bringing them as many happy, healthy years as they can.
I mean, do people now think, I think about like the rise of the medical drama, and I know you write about this a little when you kind of talk about CPR and this kind of illusion that we're under that CPR saves way more lives than it actually does. But do people expect now, because, you know, they see House on TV diagnosing everything with this team of specialists, that that's how medicine works when you're actually admitted to a hospital?
I can't speak for everyone's perceptions, but I do think a lot of people have really unrealistic ideas and expectations about death and dying. The reality is, especially in later years or when you're dealing with later stages of any chronic disease, every time you go into the hospital, every time you suffer some major setback, it's not realistic to think you're going to recover to be exactly like you were before that. There's sort of a steady decline toward the end of life. And people have expectations that the medical system is going to bring them always back to 100%. So I think it's important to be realistic about that, and because that's what leads people to not to get too somber, but have the ends of their lives happening in hospitals and in places where they didn't I envision themselves spending their final weeks or days. And if we had more conversations about realistic expectations, some people might choose things to happen differently.
Is this a place where kind of the medical community's understanding of, you know, kind of how we prolong life, maybe have our actual, you know, kind of personal feelings about death and dying and, you know, the fear that most people have about, you know, the end, has that caught up to where the medical community is? Because I feel like we see this a lot where, you know, people will prolong their life, but they don't necessarily have much quality of life left.
Right, right. It's an interesting distinction, I think, between lifespan and health span, which you hear some longevity researchers talking about. You know, how many good, high quality, happy, relatively healthy years, you know, broadly defined, do you have versus simply how long are you living? And I think when you ask a lot of people, they're certainly more concerned with health span than lifespan, but our medical system tends to focus on simply keeping people alive at all costs. And that's what most people think that they want or are presumed to want. But then when you have conversations with families about your priorities, about what you really want toward the end of your life, I think those conversations tend to yield different results.
You know, James, I'm guessing you're in a lot of situations, you know, even just, you know, in your life when you hear people make comments that are maybe based on kind of a myth or an old wives' tale, or they don't reflect the current scientific thinking or the medical research on something. Do you feel compelled when you hear people kind of spreading misinformation? Do you feel compelled to jump in and correct them?
I try to do my best. You're always assessing how bad is that misinformation. Like we talked about at the beginning, if someone is saying, "Oh, 8 glasses of water a day is what you need to do," and the alternative is they used to be drinking 8 cans of Coke every day, then I just kind of I appreciate the change, and I think that's good, and I wouldn't try to annoy anyone by saying that that's not right. So yeah, everything in context, and you have to think about what's working for people, and not always be that annoying person who's trying to correct everyone.
And do you have maybe a favorite myth that when you hear it, you just can't resist the urge letting people know, well, actually?
I try to use the phrase "well, actually" as little as possible, in my life. I think a lot about vegetarianism and veganism now, and I think a lot of people approach these things as, well, I need to give up meat and dairy, or I can just eat as much of it as I want because saturated fat is good now. So I might say, well, actually, I think it's still good, and the research would tell us that it's still good to practice moderation, and purely as a matter of, planetary sustainability too, to think about you can cut back on certain things without going full bore and picking a label and picking up a bumper sticker.
That's James Hamblin. He's the senior editor at The Atlantic and hosts a video series called If Our Bodies Could Talk. He's the author of a book by the same name. Thank you so much for joining us, James.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a lot of fun.
It's time for a break. Coming up, we'll learn about some young women from the Kansas City area who used their school newspapers to push for recognition at the turn of the 20th century. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Ellie Moxley in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, Superintendent Mark Bedell updated us on his first semester at Kansas City Public Schools and about his future plans for the district. Also, jazz legend Ramsey Lewis spoke about 60-plus years making music. Listen to those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, Steve Kraske is back to the host chair. He'll discuss the latest thinking on gender identity and transition with psychologist Wes Crenshaw. Our next guest is UMKC professor Henrietta Ricks Wood. She, too, is a former journalist, and she's written a book about the rhetorical activities of teenage girls living in Kansas City at the turn of the century. Henrietta, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sally, for having me.
Your book is Praising Girls, The Rhetoric of Young Women, 1895 to 1930. But when you say rhetoric, when you use that term, you're really kind of talking about the school newspaper, right?
Well, rhetoric is a term that often confuses or alarms people. It means persuasive discourse, writing, art, all sorts of ways of communicating and trying to make arguments. And the ways that the girls in my book were able to present their arguments were through school-sponsored publications.
So tell me a little bit more about kind of what made you want to do this project.
I was interested in the history of women in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and I was also interested in their rhetorical activities. And I had read a fair amount of scholarship about women and how they were defined, and I had read popular literature like Louisa May Alcott's famous novel, Little Women, which was published in 1868. And I was reading about famous women, people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who would become a leader of the first women's rights movement. And I got to wondering about what real girls of this time period had to say about themselves and how people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton learned how to make the amazing arguments that they did. So I had done some archival research and thought I'm going to go back to some local archives and look for examples of real writing by real girls of this time period. And in the process, I discovered that high school yearbooks and literary magazines and newspapers were a great source for their writing.
Now, I know that in the beginning you were thinking that you would do a national search for this material. I think you went so far as Indianapolis to kind of go check out what archival material you might find there. What made you decide that you could do this here in Kansas City, looking at kind of our past high schools?
Indianapolis was a wake-up call for me. Yes, I was quite ambitious when I started this. I thought I would do a national survey because what we know about girls tends to focus on East Coast girls. So I went and spent a week in Indianapolis at the State Historical Society reading microfilm, and anyone who's ever done that knows the joys of microfilm, and discovered that this integrated, a racially integrated high school in Indianapolis at this time period did not use bylines. So I could not figure out if there, when white girls were writing and when African-American girls were writing, because that was important to my analysis. So I already knew that in the Kansas City area, there were local archives that had material relevant to diverse girls at different schools. I knew that I could get information about fluent white girls who went to Miss Barstow School, the first college preparatory school for girls in Kansas City, that I could read the yearbooks and writings of girls at Lincoln High School, the first and only high school for African Americans in Kansas City until 1936. I could find material relevant to Central High School, where white working class and middle class girls went. And the Haskell Institute, which was in Lawrence, just 40 miles away, allowed me to talk about Native American girls. So I argue in the book that I was able to find information and the writing of this very diverse group in a very concentrated geographical area that has been called the crossroads of the country in 1928 and more recently. So Kansas City became a representative site for me.
So it really wasn't just that, you know, you were kind of here in Kansas City. It was that Kansas City maybe offered something that was going to be hard to find maybe elsewhere in the country, with all of these different places kind of conveniently located near one another.
It helps. Archives, despite our dream that everything will be digitized and available online, that is not the case. Lots of material has to be seen in person, on site. And it did expedite my process. It made this process much easier that it was local, but it also made it cohesive because I had to cover a lot of ground in the 35-year period that I addressed. So setting some parameters on the project did help.
Okay, so I was really cool in high school. I was both the editor of the newspaper and the yearbook. So if that tells you anything about me, I think about, you know, the kind of glossy publications we put together, you know, back in the day. Have the function of like kind of school publications changed in the last 100 years?
I think they are still a means of promoting unity in a school. Of recording history. They serve some of the same functions that they serve for the girls that I write about. So they have definitely become slicker, more professional. But these, the girls that I'm writing about, they were also at the beginning of this whole trend. After the Civil War, these yearbooks, technology and printing technology advanced to the degree that amateur periodicals were affordable. And so schools could undertake the publication of a book that was not possible earlier in the century. So, yes, they serve some of the same purposes. And it's surprising how sophisticated some of them were.
You know, I think it's funny some of the things that these girls were writing about 100 years ago. I know that there was even in the Barstow girls, there was Carolyn Shields makes this underwear joke where she's writing that without her bloomers, she wouldn't be able to, you know, play hockey, play basketball, you know, doing some of these things. And I think that kind of surprised me because I don't really associate athleticism with that time period in women. Why is that such a theme, and especially the Barstow yearbook, these girls getting involved in sport?
Well, this is a time, this is pre-Title IX for sure. Girls are not playing soccer They are not on basketball and baseball teams at this time period. There's an interest in women engaging in sports. The Barstow girls in particular, co-founder of the school and a major influence on them, Mary Elsie Barstow, was an advocate of physical activity. And I think for these white upper-class girls, it was very liberating to be encouraged to play field hockey, to be allowed to tramp around their school, which was then in Westport. They were very engaged in sports, and they talked a lot about it in their yearbook. And I think in some ways they were trying to justify, perhaps to their parents or to other readers who might question these upper-class girls getting dirty out on the field hockey field, might question what was the purpose of it. And they argued that there was an important purpose for these athletic activities.
You know, there's a lot of really charming stories in the section about the Barstow girls, but you also don't shy away from including some of the racist content that appeared in these publications. Why was it important to include that, especially going into the later chapters of your book, where you really talk about the experience of, you know, young Black women at Lincoln and young Native women at Haskell?
I analyzed some of the creative writing that was in the Barstow yearbook in order to discuss how, in some ways, while these young women were celebrating themselves, the Barstow girls were praising their identities as scholars and athletes and public performers, they also, and they're not alone in doing this, they also sort of compared themselves, created contrast against girls whom they were not. So to define who they were, they talked about who they were not. And this is also a time period where it's very common in all sorts of publications, from amateur to professional, for racist and paternalistic and politically incorrect comments to be made. Jack London was writing sort of nostalgically, but in with racist undertones about Native Americans. Minstrel shows were being played in Kansas City. It was part of the vernacular.
You know, I told you yesterday when we chatted that I really found the section about the Haskell girls, the Haskell Institute girls, very interesting, because I didn't know that much about Native education at the early 20th century. What can you kind of set us up for what was kind of the mission of these schools like the Haskell Institute? Why were these girls there? What were they learning?
The Haskell Institute, well, before 1876, the U.S. government relied on private religious organizations to educate Native Americans. For instance, the Shawnee Indian Mission, which is in Fairway, Kansas, it's now a state historic site. It was founded in 1839 by the Methodist Church to educate, to train the Shawnee Indians who had been removed to this area. Then the 1870s, the U.S. government decided to get involved in educating Native Americans. In 1879, the first government-sponsored school for Native Americans was started, the Carlisle Indian School, which was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And the idea was that by now the Indian Wars were over. Native Americans had been rounded up and corralled on reservations. Education was seen as a way to indoctrinate and to assimilate these people into society, to break down the tribal connections, to teach all these speakers of different languages how to speak English, to turn them into good Americans. The same kind of project is going on with immigrants in this time period. Education has long been seen as a tool of indoctrination. So Haskell was founded in 1884. And in Lawrence, Kansas, and initially admitted there were students as young as 5 and up to 24 at the school. And then in 1909, the Institute limited enrollment to students, teenage students. But the Haskell Institute provided academic training and also vocational training. So there was a teacher training program for a time. There was a business school. Students could also learn trades.
Someone traveling through Ottawa, Kansas, quote, would never know by the appearance of the farms that he was not among white people. That came from a Muncie teenager, Katie VX, who you talk about in your book, who attended Haskell. it doesn't sound to me like Katie's talking to her peers in that statement. Was the purpose of the Indian leader, the paper at Haskell, was it a little different in ways than, you know, kind of what we saw with the yearbook at Barstow?
Well, I think the Barstow yearbook was read primarily by Barstow students, parents, maybe the merchants who advertised in it. It was also a marketing tool. The Indian Leader was, in a sense, also a marketing tool. This newspaper was started in 1897. It was published by the Haskell Institute, and a woman served as its editor for some time, which I think had something to do with the fact that girls' writing appeared regularly in the newspaper. Katie was one of the students who was talking about and making arguments for recognizing Native Americans as good citizens, that they were really not that different from whites. So she's talking about traveling through her community and seeing how these Native Americans have adapted to farming and so forth. She's speaking, and the Haskell newspaper was distributed nationwide. It was read by both Native Americans and whites. It was read by sympathizers and skeptics. It had multiple audiences, which is a focus of that chapter. And I think Katie was speaking both to encourage pride among Native American readers and to inform and educate and persuade white readers or administrators that, in fact, Native Americans would be wonderful citizens and should be included in American society.
I know the Haskell girls, and then, you know, as you get to them, the girls at Lincoln, the young black women, they had to confront racism in a way that the girls at Barstow and Center High didn't have to. But society obviously had very different expectations for young Native women and young black women. You know, you talk about this tension between assimilation and segregation. What do you mean by that?
Well, Native Americans, there was the belief that they could be assimilated, perhaps at some level in American society, not necessarily bring them in as our equals, but certainly train them in American values and mores and provide at least vocational training or let them be teachers. So there was that effort, even though we also sent them to their own schools and kept them on reservations. In Kansas City and in many parts, other parts of the country, there was racially segregated education, and there was not encouragement for mixing and inclusion. And in the chapter about Lincoln, I talk about how the Kansas City African-American community created really kind of a parallel community that allowed people to hold important positions and influence and encourage one another in a city that did not allow blacks, for instance, to go to white movie theaters. Jim Crow code is very much in effect.
You know, I know for the girls that attended Lincoln, a lot of them, you know, they'd ride the streetcar several miles to get to there. They came from neighborhoods that didn't necessarily have electricity or running water. The school was overcrowded. You write about them holding classes in the stairwells. But you at the same time say it was radical when they started talking about expanding Lincoln or giving more opportunities to other black students.
Well, I talked in particular, one of the girls that I talk about in the Lincoln chapter, and it's probably the most famous girl in my book, is Lucille Bluford. And I assume lots of our listeners will know that Lucille Bluford is the late and great editor of the Kansas City Call, which is a major African-American newspaper established in 1919 in Kansas City and still in existence. Lots of us don't know, however, that Lucille Bluford got her start in journalism at Lincoln High School. And in my book, I talk in particular about an editorial that she wrote for the Lincoln newspaper in 1926, calling for a new school, a new facility for Lincoln, which was overcrowded and understaffed and did not have proper equipment. And she made a very compelling argument about the importance of the community pressing for a new school.
You know, just to kind of, you know, I know that there are people that really dislike the term girls to describe, you know, young women, teenagers, and that maybe some of them have been cringing, you know, as we've talked or we've used that term. But you used that title for the book. You called it Praising Girls. Was that an intentional decision?
Well, the term girls really came into popular usage in the late 1800s, according to historian Jane Hunter, who was an important source for me. Before that time, this age group was also often referred to as young ladies. So I'm amused now at grown women who call each other girls, and I think they do it usually affectionately. Girls, in some ways, has different connotations, I think, depending upon the speaker and the context. Praising girls is sort of a play. I'm talking about, and I go into more rhetorical discussion in the book, talking about a kind of rhetoric that makes use of praise and blame to create unity. So praising girls, these girls were praising themselves, but I'm also talking about the rhetoric.
Henrietta Rixwood is an associate teaching professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She'll be speaking about her book, Praising Girls, The Rhetoric of Young Women, at the Kansas City Public Library's central location on Sunday, January 15th at 2 p.m. For more information, visit our website, kcur.org/uptodate. Thanks, Henrietta.
Thanks, Ellie.
This Sunday, the NFL playoffs return to Kansas City for the first time since 2011, and the Chiefs have a chance to go further than they've gone in a generation. But as commentator Victor Wishna explains in this edition of A Fan's Notes, that's not all that's on the line.
The Kansas City Chiefs are two wins away from a Super Bowl, so perhaps you'll forgive all the hype. But why do we care? What does it really mean for players and fans alike? Glory? Fame? Pride? Or something more basic, like a little respect? It's one of the ironies of playing games as a profession. The possibility to achieve mythical glory and net million-dollar paydays, to see your name in lights, your face on billboards, your every success splashed across high-definition flat screens around the world, and still not get the respect you deserve. That's especially true in the NFL, where overabundant machismo masks locker rooms full of fragile egos. The smallest verbal slight goes right up on the proverbial bulletin board, lest anyone forget just what they're fighting for, a little respect. For fans, too, this is one more way in which the drama of sports can speak to the drama of our own lives. That same yearning for dignity easily gets tied up in our teams. That can be a good thing, such as when the Royals' title run galvanized our city and bolstered our collective reputation and identity. But when we don't quite reach that plateau, we easily lash out at those seen as most responsible. Chiefs quarterback Alex Smith has been a favorite target for a long time. Google Alex Smith critics, and the first hit to come up, of more than 700,000, is from 2011. Smith had just led the San Francisco 49ers to a 13-3 record and the NFC title game, where only a heartbreaking overtime loss kept them from the Super Bowl. Smith is, though most people don't realize it, one of the winningest quarterbacks in the league over the last half dozen seasons. No, he's not Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers, but he is third, right behind them in total victories as a starter. He's even more effective in the postseason against the best competition and under the most pressure, with the fourth highest QB rating in NFL history, better than Joe Montana, Troy Aikman, and Steve Young. Sure, those other quarterbacks I mentioned have 13 Super Bowl titles between them and 9 MVP awards. All in all, Smith's individual stats are not the kind you'd find on a Hall of Fame resume. And because he's played with top 10 defenses and almost always with a strong running game, he can't seem to shake the less-than-flattering label of game manager. Is that any way to treat the guy who has the best passer rating and most rushing yards of any quarterback in Chiefs history? How about a little respect? Andy Reid, likewise, is one of the most successful NFL coaches, yet he too has been ridiculed, usually for his lack of game management. It's largely why, despite 9 playoff runs, 5 title games, and a Super Bowl, he managed to get himself fired by the Philadelphia Eagles. Of course, it's hard to please folks in the city of brotherly love who once threw ice balls at Santa. Reid knows that down the stretch, Smith has been playing some of the best football of his career, though his detractors may not admit it. They'll credit the emergence of weapons like Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill for the improvement. But what if that's backwards? Alex does what great quarterbacks do. He makes everyone around him better, said Reed, who has the Kansas City Chiefs playing at Arrowhead in the divisional round for the first time in well over a decade. The Chiefs haven't won a home playoff game since 1994, which was also the last time they advanced to the AFC Championship. On Sunday, they could do both. And for Reed, for Smith, for Kansas City, that would mean something. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take off TCB.
Victor Wishna is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Lenexa. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcasts at kcur.org/uptoday. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Uptoday, and I'm at Ellie Moxley. Steve Kraske will be returning to the host chair on Monday. He and psychologist Wes Crenshaw will discuss the latest thinking on gender identity. We had help this week from Brian Ellison, Steven Steigman, Matt Hodapp, Chris Pruitt, Matthew Long Middleton, Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Ellie Moxley, and you are up to date.